Thanks for the Nayash for inviting me, who is not here. He's very busy. And also thanks to Kurt, who hosted my seminar. And today is a big day for this Unruh Fest. So I will try to finish as soon as possible, and then you have energy to attend the afternoon talk. And today I'm going to talk about the electrodynamic effects of inflationary graviton. And I will just give the very quick review of the background geometry. And actually, in this talk, I will report several the different work by different person, most of not by me. It's all the theory which a photon coupled to gravity during the primordial inflation. Okay, and I will try to skip the technical details and try to discuss it with a more physical intuition part. Okay, so. So we all know at the large scales, I mean about 100 megaparsec, our universe looks homogeneous and isotropic and almost a spatial fillet. So we can use this Friedmann-Rosenberg-Walker geometry. And we all know the A is scale factor, so it's controlled the spatial part of distance. And in this geometry, we know the physical distance is not just coordinate separation, it's actually the scale factor, the time-dependent function. Times this coordinate separation, okay, and also you know the wave number is involved with the wavelength in the denominator. So, but we do not really write this wavelength as the a times lambda, right? So this is why the physical wave number have to divide by a. So we say the physical momentum is k over a in this background, okay. And if you know A is keep growing with time, then you know the physical momentum get reshaped. And also, from the current data, we know the upper bound of a tensor to scalar ratio, which inferred epsilon is a Forster-Thoreau parameter, almost equal to zero, which corresponding to the de Sitter background. And the calculation I report today actually is all in the de Sitter background. And we know in the de Sitter background, or we say that during primordial inflation, H is constant. So for the general Friedmann-Rosenberg-Walker, you can arbitrary function of scale factor, but for a special case, when you set H equal to constant, you can solve this scale factor by definition of Hubble parameter, and you will see the scale factor grows like exponential HT. Okay, so the primordial inflation actually is maximally accelerated expanding space-time. And also from the current data constraint, this scalar primordial pulse spectrum and also upper bound the tensors to scalar ratio, we know the Hubble parameter during the primordial inflation is about 10 to 14 GeV. This is very high energy scale. So all the particles we consider can be treated as effectively masses. Okay, and also from the current data constraint, we see this GH square, which we call the loop counting parameters for the this quantum gravity. It's very small, okay, it's less than 5 times 10 to minus 11. So this means we still can calculate using the perturbations theory, still works. You might argue, okay, this loop counting parameters, coupling constant is so small, then why you bother compute anything? But I said, remember this background. H is time dependent, so the object you compute in this background might carry some time dependence. In some case, this time dependence will grow with time, so might finally overwhelm the smallness of loop counting parameters. So it's some you might still get some significant result, will not entirely negligible. Okay, because we all consider this loop effect, so we can qualitatively think of why is the quantum loop effect? Basically, you can think of quantum loop effects as just a virtual particle, how virtual particle respond, how classical particle respond to the virtual particles. And you will say, okay, if you have more virtual particle emerge from the vacuum, or this virtual particle lasts longer than in the space-time, then this virtual particle will have more chance to interact with the classical particles, and hence bring the bigger quantum loop effect. Okay, so you know in the phase space time, masses of particle live longer. Okay, so this is why we see the vacuum polarization. We also see this EM force, which is stronger at the short distance. This is the same in this de Sitter space. Okay, so the masses of particle live longer and hence give a bigger loop quantum effect. And also, inflation did the other thing compared with the phase space time. You can imagine a pair of virtual particles emerge from the vacuum. Okay, very soon in the phase space time, we'll come back to a vacuum. But remember, this primordial inflation is such an accelerated expansion geometry. So this pair of virtual particles emerge from the vacuum and solved like a trip into the Hubble flow in some very low, low momentum, very long wavelength or mode that might just never come back. Okay, so there's some particle production. So the massless particle during the primordial inflation, in principle, can give you a very big quantum loop effect. However, there's one thing. Except how this particle lives in the phase space time, the other thing is how many they can emerge from the vacuum. And the most massless particle, actually, they have one symmetry we call conformal invariant symmetry. And this symmetry actually will suppress this emergence rate. So even though this massless particle during the primordial inflation, they have a chance to live very, very longer, much longer than phase space time, but very, very few emerge from the vacuum. Okay. However, there are two very special kinds. This massless minimal couple scalars, and the other is graviton. They both achieve this zero mass without classical conformal invariance. So mainly in this case, we will consider these two kinds of particles. And here I just give the roughly more quantitative the way to look at why you have some particle production. And actually in the 1946, Lifshitz actually find out the dynamical graviton's behave like a massless minimal couple scalar. So if just for simplicity, we can just look at this massless minimal couple scalar. And you can find the Lagrangian, okay? And if you do the spatial Fourier transform, you will find out each mode behave like a tie-dependent simple harmonic oscillator. You can see it's 1/2 m q dot square, 1/2 m omega square, q square, something like that. Okay, and this mass is behave like a scale fat cube, and the angular frequency is kc over a. Okay, so if you know this is a simple harmonic oscillator, it's easier to solve because you want to know how to solve this from the undergraduate. You just write down this Heisenberg equation of motion and write down this operator in terms of mode function multiplied by this appropriate annihilation or creation operator. And if you want to solve general for the Friedman-Rosen worker, it's harder, but for the theta mode function, it's very simpler. It's like takes this form. X we define as physical momentum in terms of Hubble units. So this dimension is parameters. And actually, we also can compute the energy. And you know, in the phase space time, the zero point energy only 1/2 h omega. In the theta, actually, or in the expanding space time, you have an extra form. This n we call the occupation number. Okay, and the occupation number is takes this form 1/2x. And you will see when the occupation number becomes significant, when x roughly equal to 1, okay? There is physical momentum, k over a, roughly equal to h. And you also will see when this x becomes very, very small, mode function is become constant because this term very small, you can drop out. And if this is very less than 1, exponential very close to 0, this term is equal to 1, so it becomes a constant. And actually, in cosmology, we call this the fourth horizon crossing. And this is significant later. We will mention why the physical momentum is roughly equal to Hubble parameter in our calculation. And the motivation of the project mainly is the photon coupled to gravity. Actually motivated by the my thesis calculation. My thesis calculation actually is graviton coupled to massless fermion. And then we compute the fermion self-energy using a dimensional regularization at one loop order. And later we use this fermion self-energy to solve this linearized Dirac equation and find out the fermion mode function grows like GH squared times logarithm A. So this is what I mentioned at the beginning, even though this loop counting parameter is very small, but this tie-gradient phase, so might be significant, okay? And the funny thing is, compare this model with the other one, that is the massless minimal couple scalar coupled to gravity. In this model, actually, what they compute, Kaya and Professor Wooder, for the compute is Mesis minima couple scalar, safe Mesis square. That is the scalar get the contribution from the graviton. In principle, just from the previous this argument, the graviton is non-conformal invariant theory and supposed to bring a bigger effects. So supposed to have this kind of secure growth like the fermion model. But in their species, the one loop calculation, they do not find any enhancement. Okay, this is kind of strange, but later we realize that is because in this model, because we no scalar, no spin at all, and the infrared graviton only can couple to this Mesis Minkoff scalar through the reshaped kinetic terms. For the fermion, of course, they also couple to the reshaped kinetic term. This reshaped kinetic term at late time become very small, okay, become negligible. But fermion is half spin particles. You have spin, and the spin do not fall off. And this is why we found the enhancement in this model, but not in this model. And actually later in this paper, we actually identified turn by turn, find out all the secular growth in this model indeed come from the spin-spin interaction, the spin of gravitons coupled to spin of fermions. And we also derived a simple rule to catch in the leading infrared logarithm. It's different from the Swarovski IR truncation, but this is not the main topic I want to talk about here, just to mention it. And when Stanley Des knew about this work, and he immediately suggests, why not consider photon? Because photon also have spin. So this is why this kind a serious project started. Okay, so what we did actually very simple. I mean, just from the, you can talk about it very simple. This is Einstein-Hilbert term. This is a photon. Okay, and the computer, the vacuum polarization, using the dimensional regression and the one loop order diametrically, it can be represented by this main two Feynman diagrams. And this wavy line stands for the photons. Curly line stands for the gravitons. And this is the counter turns. And we also renormalize the ultraviolet divergence using the BPHB counterterms. It turns out that we need two invariant one and one non-invariant one. I will comment on later why we need this one. And the thing to do is the same as the previous. We just quantum correct this linearized Maxwell equation. This is the vacuum polarization. Then the first order, you just solve it perturbatively. Okay, so the first order you solve this integrates over this vacuum polarization against this three order gauge potential. Of course, in this thing, you can look at the different, for example, you can look at source to zero late dynamical gravitons. You also can look at different source. For example, you can look at a point charge or a magnetic dipole. And okay, this is the thing. Okay, and the first calculation, okay, sorry, before we go into the details, I want to mention one thing. That is how we understand this vacuum polarization, because it's a different version of vacuum polarization in phase space time. We know in the phase space time, we say the vacuum polarization is electron positron polarized vacuum, and you have some screening effects. So if you have a bigger screening effects, then the force between this charged particles is smaller. But in this case, when we say the vacuum polarization, actually is photon get a contribution from graviton. Graviton's no charge, photon also no charge. Okay, so what do you mean by the vacuum polarization? Okay, we say actually you can think of this way. The dynamical photon basically carry a momentum like H bar CK. And this is a physical momentum will get reshaped at late times like K over A. Because you know this photon is conformal invariant theory, so they will not produce continuously. However, the infrared gravitons is non-conformal invariant theory. So if you have a wave K and the wave number K and the wavelength lambda, because it's non-conformal invariant theory, and we just saw you have this occupation number, and this infrared graviton will keep producing. And we can say roughly, okay, this physical momentum of infrared gravitons like Hubble scales, okay? So if you compare these two momentum, the momentum of graviton is much larger than physical momentum of photons. When this particle collides with a photon, you will see they must have a big change of the momentum in the photon part. And the virtual photons, because the momentum big change with time, then the force carrying the virtual photon will also have a big change. And this is why we say this vacuum correlation come out. Okay, the first work, okay, is the simple exercise in the phase space time. Also, this is the photon coupled to these gravitons and compute this vacuum polarization. And by Lehnert and Woodard, kappa square is 16 pi g, okay, and we define this delta square, delta x square, this event length, sort of like event length square. And this vacuum polarization can be written as this tensor form times this. You can actually can get this kind of form by dimensional analysis. Kappa square just indicates this one loop correction. And in this calculation, you only, because in the phase space time, you only have most singular turn and you only need one counter turns, is this one. And after you renormalize, okay, you got this kind of turns. And when they study the dynamical photons in phase space time, they find out no any significant change. Okay, and from the dynamical photons behavior, they can infer this Coulomb potential. And the first term is just a classical term. The second term is g over r squared. And the coefficient of g over r squared actually exactly agree with the Rutkowski found in the 1970s. Rutkowski actually he used the source theorem. Compute the correction to the free graviton propagate, and he also got this kind of term g over r squared, and the coefficient r exactly agree with each other. And if you want to understand this physically, I mean, you can think of this sort of like the zeroth order photon distorts this virtual gravitons nearby, and this. Virtual gravitons will change a lot this virtual the momentum of virtual photons, which you will see this Rutkowski piece, this is g over r squared. But no secular growth in phase space time at all. This is a dynamical graviton part in phase space time. And later, they also compute this vacuum polarization in discrete space. In exactly the same theory, the same Lagrangian, but not in space-time, in discrete space. And in this calculation, they need to use the two kind of tensor to represent the vacuum polarization. This is because the graviton propagate they use actually breaks De Sitter. The gauge fixing of a graviton propagate actually breaks the De Sitter, so this is why they have extra purely spatial part. E top bar mu nu is defined as this way, so this is purely spatial part. So we call this part f. F is a structural function. G is the other structural function for this De Sitter breaking part. Okay, and because of this De Sitter breaking, so this is why we need the non-invariant count turns, because we know. There are two things will affect the count turns you choose. For example, the regression technique and also the gauge fixing. Because the count turns have to respect all the symmetry, regression techniques you choose, and also the gauge fixing. When you compute the Feynman diagram, if you encounter the propagators, you always need to do the gauge fixing. And this great gauge fixing sometimes. Of course, it always will break some symmetry of general coordinate invariance, but it might still preserve De Sitter invariant symmetry. But in this case, it happens breaks the De Sitter. So this is why we need the non-invariant count turns. Okay, and of course.
Is it impossible to choose a scheme that preserves the Sitter invariance?
Yes, this is a very good point because in the later calculation, we try to compute also the same, exactly the same object. This is a vacuum polarization in the decision space. And we use the different Graviton propagates, which we use the one family, the one parameter family exact gauge fixing. And this is covariant. But the funny things I will tell you later, it's happened, we still need a non-event counter. This is a surprising thing we found because actually, when we use this old, we call old Graviton propagator, because it's easy to use. Because if you never compute anything, we'll say, well, why not just use the covariant one? Of course, we like to use the covariant one. But later, I will show you how complicated it is. Okay, it's a very good point. And here is do exactly the same thing. We linearize, solve this mode function. From this linearized Maxwell equation. And this part is actually at the beginning is a vacuum polarization integrate against this gauge potential A. And here, if you just put this form of vacuum polarization, so here you will find out there's two derivatives. One is on x, the other is on x plane. So we just simplify it. We take the derivative on x outside the integral. And the derivative on x plane into the gauge potential, so you form the field strength. And you have two parts, is the structural function f from the covariant one and the structural function g from the breaking one. Okay, so you do exactly the same thing as before, but right now, because you start the object in De Sitter, so we use the Schwinger-Keldysh formula. Sometimes you heard it's the in-in formula, and this is just try to get the results. Causal and the real, and I will not to just I will not to talk about the details of this Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, but you must heard before. Okay, here just to show you this Liouville calculation, one loop structural functions, where this is the f, the structural function. You will see the bunch of this local term, okay, and this non-local terms. These are all non-local terms. And this decision breaking part of a structural function is all local term, non-local term. And you see alpha, beta, where is gamma? Oh, gamma here. This is arbitrary finite part of Cartesian. Okay. And of course, they also go ahead to study the dynamical photon. So they just proceed the previous procedure. And of course, right now, you have to substitute this three-order field strength, this zero I part and this ij part. And because you know the photon is conformal invariant, so this the mode function, the three-order is exactly the same as the phase space time. Okay. And we also use this effective field equation only at the late heights because this is only a reliable situation. Why? Because we do not really correct this initial state, because this is the interacting theory. For the interacting theory, you already have to correct initial state, but we do not do that. And the reason we do not do that is because we believe the correction from the initial state might fall off and become insignificant. And also, the thing we care in this study is logarithm A, which is the growth with the time dependent and the growing with time. So this arbitrary shift of this finite part of Cartesian become not important. You know this is not the renormalizable theory, and you say you do the finite shift of this finite part of Cartesian, you get entirely different prediction. This is true, okay, entirely true, but what we care is the logarithm A part, and the logarithm A part, it's late time, actually much bigger, actually it dominates this finite shift, so this is why we can just ignore. And this is also why we only use the effective field equation at late times. And what they found at one loop, they find out the electric field actually grows with time, but the magnetic field which is fall off is like logarithm A divided by A. Okay. And of course, you can think of it's like when the photon propagates through the ensemble of infrared graviton, which is created by primordial inflation, and it gets distorted a little bit. So this is why the electric field and the magnetic field are slightly different. I mean, actually, this part is bigger than the phase-space time. We have talked about the previous computation in phase-space time for the dynamical photon part. Dynamical photons do not have any secure growth. And this also demonstrates what we said at the beginning. During the primordial inflation, this loop quantum phase becomes much bigger. You can see from this study. And this is just a minor mention. You can see the perturbation eventually breaks down when the logarithm A larger than 10 to 10 E14s, much, much larger E14s, okay, than the constraint from the CME. And in order to talk about the later effects, the late study, actually, we study, or I start to involve the project from this point, we'll consider two kinds of observer. One is the observer from the source. Actually, we call this the Poincaré page coordinate. And if you have a four-digit manifold, you just cut it in half, and this is a Poincaré page in the core. This eta is a co-moving time from minus infinity to zero. But the important thing is the physical distance in this manifold, in this coordinate, will change with time, it grows with time. Okay? And the other is observer. This observer actually have a fixed distance from the source to this observer. Okay, so this physical distance in static coordinates will not change with time. And because I need to report the two situations, this is just we took the Lanard and Wooders calculation and quantum correct Maxwell equation. And here we put a different source. This all in co-moving coordinates is the physical distance change with time. And this source is a point charge. This is a magnetic dipole. Okay? And we find out this Coulomb potential get distorted. This is fourth order correction because you can see the kappa square, h square. This is a classical term. And you will see this term, h square, get canceled from numerator and the denominator. So this is sort of like a Rakowski piece. And this is entirely the De Sitter piece. And you will find out for the point charge, Coulomb potential actually grows with time because you see the logarithm A here. Okay. And this is just what I mentioned at the beginning. If you have this physical momentum of gravitons around the Hubble scales, which are much larger than the physical momentum of photons, and when they collide with each other, this virtual photons momentum gets a big change with time. So the force carrier, of course, also have big change. And this is what we saw here. And this is the magnetic dipole source. And this is a classical piece. This is a one-loop correction. You also have this the Rakowski piece. And this part actually do not have any secure growth. And all this results in this conformal coordinates. And we also look at the static coordinates for the same source, for the point charge, and also for the magnetic dipole. And find out the situation is slightly different. We also see this one-loop correction, but do not have secure growth at the static coordinates. On the other hand, for this magnetic dipole, it's kind of funny, become very complicated. This is electric field, this is magnetic field, this is a classical term, this is one-loop correction. And this is a Rakowski piece. And you find out the minus, and you have logarithm in the denominator of this logarithm argument. So minus minus, you get a positive sign. So this one is also growing. And this term has become very complicated, but you can recognize this part is classical piece. Kappa squared, h squared, this is all correction from the one loop. And if you compare, for example, this term, this is classical term, and this is one loop correction term, you all have proportional to m to k. So this minus and the logarithm, the a argument in the denominator, so this also grows. And if you look at, for example, the term proportional to m, dot r half k, that is this term. Oh, no, sorry, is this term. The minus minus is plus. So you find out here you have minus and the log is an a also in the denominator. So this also grows. We find a very funny situation. That is for the magnetic dipole at the stated coordinates. Actually, it grows with time. So right now I'm going to talk about the gauge issue. Why we want to talk about gauge issue? We say, okay, because vacuum polarization is not gauge independent quantity, right? So then you have to worry about the gauge issue. And of course, when you compute the Feynman diagram, every time when you have this propagator, you always have to do the gauge fixing. Otherwise, you will not get any propagator. For photon one, actually, you do not need to worry about it because it's coupled to field strength, and this is independent gauge independent part, so you do not need to worry. However, for the graviton ones, the gauge fixing for the graviton propagator, you need to worry about. For example, this is a phase-based tie. If you use one family parameter gauge fixing, B could be the arbitrary number, except B equal to 2, okay? Then this is a vacuum polarization in the phase-based tie. This part is fixed because it can be fixed by dimensional analysis. And this tensor part also fixed because Poincaré invariance. And C2 is the Calterns, spin 2 part of Calterns. C0 is the spin 0 part of Calterns. And you will find out at the phase-based tie, C2 part actually vanish because in four dimension, okay, and also do not have any gauge dependent because you do not see any B here. However, for the spin zero part, it's heavily gauge independent. You see a lot of B parameter evolved and also do not vanish in four dimension, okay. So this kind of, this part is fixed. This part is fixed. This part is fixed by Poincaré symmetry. This part is fixed by dimensional analysis. But the coefficient in front of it is actually highly gauge independent. Highly gauge dependent. So how can you fix it? The good thing is this is a calculation in phase-based tie, and you have way to fix it because we have a gauge independent S matrix. Okay. So I don't know how to pronounce this correctly. Birion Bohr. He actually used the inverse scattering method from this gauge independent S matrix and infer the part of a vacuum polarization from graviton contribution. And because this is gauge independent calculation, so coefficient must be entirely correct. It's gauge independent. So we can use this to fix the gauge dependence for vacuum polarization in phase-based time. This is in phase-based time, so gauge issue can be solved. And before go on the new thing, I would like to talk about some misconception about the gauge issues. There are three misconceptions. The first is gauge fixed Green's function are complete nonsense. So every time when people say this is a gauge dependent quantity and you should not trustable, it's true, but you should not throw them away immediately because you think of how people construct gauge independent S matrix. Actually, this gauge independent S matrix is formed by each gauge fixed Green's function, right? So you cannot say because this gauge fixed Green's function is gauge dependent, you just throw it away. It's not true. The thing is you need to try to distinguish the physical part from the non-physical part. And this is the phase-based tie QFT people find out to form this gauge independent S matrix. So what I want to mention is even though the vacuum polarization is highly gauge dependent, but you should not throw it away because it might contain some physical information. We just need to find a way to separate the physical one from non-physical one. And the second misconception is gauge invariant Green's function are different from gauge fixed Green's function. You say, okay, I say this is a kind of misconception. Why? Because you know, every gauge fixed Green's function can be represent, you always can in invariantize this gauge fixed Green's function. It can represent some invariant operator. One example is if you consider 1 plus 1 dimension, this EM, and you look at this total temporal gauge. For example, you consider this one, and you always can write A1, this gauge potential, in terms of integral, a form of integral of this field strength 0,1. Okay, and this is a gauge invariant. Okay, this always gauge invariant. You can argue this is nonsense because you understand EM very well. You will not use this gauge invariant quantity. What I want to mention is, okay, if you want to find the some observable, I mean physical observable, only find the gauge invariant is not enough. So you should not criticize the gauge fixed Green's function. It's the same thing. This is Wooders. This is work. It's a kind of, I don't know. This is we call the actually this invariant operator we call the Mendenstam variable is also is invariant operator, but it's also formed by each piece of gauge fixed Green's function. And the third misconception is people regard this a trivial problem. I say no, it's not trivial. Why? Because in the Friedman-Rosenberg work in cosmology, we do not have well-defined S matrix. That means we do not have something we can compare with to fix this gauge dependence problem. And what we need, we always can find a serious gauge invariant operator. Okay, but no guarantee this gauge invariant operator really corresponded to something we really measured. What I mean is the physical observable. So I don't think this is a trivial problem. And actually, I don't know how to solve this now.
Wrong with saying that it's dual
CFT correlator? I don't know the CFT correlator. What do you mean by CFT correlator?
Consider space, you can think of future infinity as being formal field theory that lives there. CFT, those invariant things we're supposed to be measuring.
Oh no, okay, this is a good point. Let me mention again, because for example, you say the physical observable must be gauge invariant, okay? But the gauge invariant observable might not really corresponding to the thing you really measured. You always can find a serious gauge invariant operator, right? For example, one is gauge invariant, but one is kind of gauge invariant operator do not tell you anything physical. So I don't know, you say the CFT stuff because I'm not CFT people. I have very little knowledge about CFT. I don't know, maybe you can find a lot of gauge invariant operator. Okay.
This has to do with the dictionary. So it's for sure true our observational friends who we heard from earlier this week are measuring something up in the sky, right? Tell me in terms of the dictionary what that corresponds to in terms of CFTs, and then you're done.
They're measuring CFT correlators at future infinity.
So what if they calculate that the power spectrum is thus and such, what does that mean in terms of the CFT correlator in Sitter space plus your favorite matter theory?
Yeah, it's a two-point function. Two-point
correlator. Okay, it is true they're measuring two points,
yeah.
So you got that one right, but what operators do I look at? What thing do I look at? And I would say it's not so easy. And if you think it is, you write a paper, because I would say this is probably the number three biggest problem in cosmology, is identifying what are the observables.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Let me continue here. Actually, we have a conjecture about this leading secular growth term. Because we find the leading enhancement, leading infrared enhancement, for example, in fermion coupled to gravity, also in this photon coupled to gravity, and our conjecture is maybe this leading secular growth maybe is gauge independent, and we believe this is because if you think of physical part of gauge independent S matrix. Actually, this is the pole turn at this external legs. So in the momentum space, this is the thing you are familiar with, is have some I times field strength normalization divided by the P square, for example, minus M square plus I epsilon. So maybe I should write it down. Okay, such as this term, this is a physical part of gauge independent as matrix. And when you put it on shell, you mean so you just put the p square equal to m square. But right now, if you consider in the position space, you do the Fourier transform of this term, okay? So when you want to put it on shell in the momentum space, then it means you will have some integral. This is a momentum. This is what I mean put on shell. This is in momentum space. This is easy and you are familiar with. You just put a p square equal to m square in the position space if you want to make it on shell. What you do is do this integral, okay, with just the transformation against the three order mode function. And you will find out actually this is very similar to the thing we did for the quantum correct linearized Maxwell equation, because remember the second term, what we did is in the four dimension, you have, for example, you have this vacuum polarization. And when you solve the perturbativity, okay, and this part will have a similar form like this. So this is kind of a similar analog what we did when you do this linearized quantum correct linearized Maxwell equation. So this is why we suspect maybe the leading infrared algorithm is gauge independent. Okay, so this is one thing. And how do you make sure? I mean, the thing you can check is you, because we do not have anything we can compare, like in phase space time, we do not have well-defined S matrix like phase space time. So the thing right now we can do is recompute the same object in the other gauge, okay? And for the photon propagator, it doesn't matter because it coupled to the field strength. And for the graviton one, this is the Kurt mentioned before, why not use the covariant one? Yes, right now we try to use the covariant one. This is the work by Morat, Thomas, and Wooder. They use this one parameter family exact gauge fixing to get the graviton propagator. Okay, then right now we start to use the covariant gauge fixing for the graviton propagator. Before that, let me just show you why at the beginning we use the non-covariant one, because it's very simple. This we rescale the matrix this way. And we call all the graviton propagator. Okay, this is the first time we know how to use the graviton propagator to compute anything, the Feynman diagram. And actually it's very simple because the tensor part is constant, okay? And you have tensor A, B, C, and individually types the A, B, C type of propagator, scalar propagator. And the A, B, C type of scalar propagator is also very simple. In four dimension, for example, A type takes this form, and B and C type takes 1 over Y this form. It's very, very simple. So the price you pay is, of course, it breaks the decision invariance, and you have to use the non-invariant counterterms. And when we use the new graviton propagator, okay, they consist of, I mean, this graviton propagator, this we use the one parameter family is that gauge, and the thing we get from the gauge fixing, it takes the two part, the spin two part, spin zero part. Okay, this is spin two part, this is spin zero part. Okay, and this is projector, it consists of four covariant derivative on x, the other on x plane. So here I have eight covariant derivative, and then acting on these things, I don't know how to call this, the invariant length square, the two derivative acting on it, and the spin two part of a structural function, okay? And the spin zero part will be easy, but it still consists of, each projector still consists of two operator. So totally here have two covariant derivative. So totally here have a four covariant derivative. So you will see it's vastly complicated. And one thing I want to mention is the spin two part is gauge independent because you cannot see any B dependence here. And the spin zero part is highly gauge dependent, okay, because you can find beta everywhere. And one thing I want to mention is when this B larger than two, this part becomes De-Sitter invariant, okay. So this is why we say, okay, you can use the new Graviton propagator, this is a covariant, and we indeed try to do, and we reject the same thing, we compute the same object. Okay, but this is really, really complicated. And in the four dimension, this part and this part also consists of this infinite series expansion. It is not become a simple form in four dimension like the previous old Graviton propagator. The funny thing is that we thought that we can get rid of non-covariant color terms, but in this calculation is a surprise. It will surprise us a lot because we also find out that we still need non-invariant color term. And the thing happened is you took one Feynman diagram, this is a 2-3-point vertex Feynman diagram, and this is a Graviton propagator, this is a photon propagator, this two derivative acting on the photon propagator, and this is the 3-point vertex. There are 2 3-point vertex, the other index here. And because we use the in-in formulas, and so it required a tie order of this tie order of this interaction. And there's one situation that is when two derivative acting on the photon propagator, then it will give a delta function times this temporal duration. And when you set up a coincidence limit of a Graviton propagator, coincidence limit of a Graviton propagator consists of a divergent part, okay? So you have a divergent part, and also you have this spatial temporal duration, so it still breaks De-Sitter invariance in this calculation. It's a kind of a very irritating thing, okay? Because we thought we can get rid of a non-covariant color term, but it still occurs here. And you might argue why you use the tie order. I mean, why not you use the covariant order? We can use the covariant order, but it will cause very big disturbance when you start to use the Schwinger-Kadish formalism. So this is why we choose use the tie order, and because we need to compute, we need to quantum correct this linearized Maxwell equation, and this requires tie order. And then you find out this happened. We still need the non-covariant color terms. I will say it's the Lorentz invariance in De-Sitter is sort of corresponding to some kind of symmetry in De-Sitter. And the thing is, if you use. I'm sorry?
It's a point number three.
Okay, first I did, I'm not sure you're asking.
This would occur, number one, point number one and two occur even in flat space. It's point three if it's different from the center of the flat space.
Yeah, but if you use Euclidean signature, you will not have this problem. But the thing is, the physics actually based on the Minkowski signature. So if you use the Euclidean, for example, you analytically continue the object from Euclidean space, and you will not find you will find that you do not need to use this non-invariant counter, because if you analytically continue, and you will find out this is a four covariant here, you will not pick up the delta zero mu delta zero nu here. But actually, there are some danger to use the analytical continuation, which you will find out. For example, you should not use the dimensional regression to deal with invariant divergence. The thing is, you have to redefine the question you ask. So dimensional regression is kind of analytical continuation technique. And the other danger, as you will find out, if you use the analytical continuation from, for example, you analytically continue from Euclidean space and get a propagator, Graton propagator, and you'll find out this so-called Graton propagator, but actually it's not a real propagator. It's sort of like, because we say the propagator is defined as the tie order of two field products in the presence of normalized state. But if you Euclidean continue from Euclidean space, then you find out this in the presence of negative known states, which is not physical at all. So, well, yeah. And here, just to show you the complex thing, we find out using the new Graton propagator. This is a complex digamma function plus this bunch of junk. And we have some familiar form with the previous the results, which use the all the Graton propagator, for example, this kind of term, this term, local term, this non-local term, is easier to deal with. But the new part is this one. Okay, this is complicated, and we have to investigate again. And we don't know what kind of thing will bring out from this kind of form. And also, this is also a new piece. Okay, so this is spin two part of a structural function. One is covariant one, the other is non-covariant one. And this is spin zero part. And all is the new piece is this one and this one, because I do not have space. This n sub f of y, n sub g of y is very complicated. It also contains a kind of infinite series expansion. So this kind of new term, we need to look at it again. Otherwise, we don't know what will come out. So finally, this is the conclusions. And yeah, this is the thing I just mentioned. Some terms are the same, but some terms are different. We have to do we have to investigate further. And what we really want to do is to check out our conjecture, that is the leading infrared algorithm. Well, not this leading infrared algorithm is gauge independent or not. Okay, this is a very tedious calculation and straightforward. So finally, I will want to say something that is just from physical intuition. For example, right now, if you have a photon and this photon propagates through to this ensemble of infrared gravitons, okay, then it gets hit by random walking of infrared gravitons. Of course, this photon's behavior will change. It seems to me it's a very physical thing. I don't believe this is a, I mean, gauge artifact, which you can just do some kind of transformation and gauge that away. But we still need to check, okay? So there are a lot of things. And the important step in the cosmology, in the Friedland-Robinson work, this quantum field theory, we have a lot of things we have not understand yet. So maybe there are more genius person can tell me how to proceed. And thanks very much. I think this is all. Yeah, finished.
Thank our speaker again.
Okay.